I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Earlier this week, the Senate Judiciary Committee approved the nomination of Neil Gorsuch for the U.S. Supreme Court along party lines. Here's Senators Feinstein, Coons, Franken, Schumer, and McConnell voicing their opinions.
Based on Judge Gorsuch's record at the Department of Justice, his tenure on the bench, his appearance before the Senate, and his written questions for the record, I cannot support this nomination.
It is based on these and many other concerns that I've detailed in my questioning, my questions for the record, and in further statements I've made, that I will ultimately vote against Judge Gorsuch's nomination today.
And in the absence of sufficient answers and honest answers to questions that were posed during the hearing, I oppose his nomination.
I'm voting no on Gorsuch for Alphonse Madden and workers across the country, for the Wong family, and for others who don't want to choose between their health and providing for their children, and for the Perkins family, who love their children just as they are and want them no less than the opportunities afforded to every other child in America.
Judge Gorsuch is independent, and he's fair. He's beyond qualified, and he'll make a stellar addition to the Supreme Court. Hardly anyone in the legal community seems to argue otherwise. And yet, our Democratic colleagues appear poised to block this incredible nominee with the first successful partisan filibuster in American history.
Well, the Democrats did filibuster the nomination, and yesterday Republicans voted to end the 60-vote threshold for nominees to the Supreme Court, passing something called the nuclear option, again along party lines. The full Senate is expected to vote today, and barring some unforeseen event, Neil Gorsuch will be the newest member of the court. Ed O'Keefe is congressional reporter for The Washington Post and has been following the drama this week. And Ed, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you.
So what's the significance of what happened this week?
Well, the significance is that Neil Gorsuch will, as you said, barring any unforeseen circumstances, become the 113th member of the U.S. Supreme Court. For the Senate itself, there were some significant housekeeping duties that were changed up in that they have essentially made clear that from now on, any presidential nominee, whether it's a cabinet secretary, a commission chairman, a district court judge, or a Supreme Court justice, can be confirmed with a simple majority of senators, and no longer can a senator throw up the procedural roadblock known as a filibuster to slow down the debate, seek consensus, and then move forward or reject the nomination. This had been done only a few times over the course of U.S. history, but it was done by senators in the past who had raised concerns about the qualifications of a judge. In this case, the Gorsuch filibuster that happened only briefly yesterday came at the end of what I would say was about 15, 16 years, really, of partisan squabbling over the ideological balance of federal courts. Democrats and Republicans have done this to judicial nominees of George W. Bush and Barack Obama in the last 16 years, and it was basically brought to an end yesterday when Republicans did what they did and said, no, from now on, we only do it with a majority vote.
Where does that leave the minority, whether Republican or Democrat? If they don't have the filibuster, do they have any tools to go up against a nominee for whether the court or the federal government?
All they can really do is slow down the inevitable at that point. But remember, you know, we're living right now in a Republican-dominated Washington where the Republican president is working with the Republican Congress. Some other day, it could be a Republican president working with a Democratic Senate or a Democratic president working with a Republican Senate. And that will require more consensus. That will require more advice and consenting, frankly, before a Supreme Court nominee is made. And perhaps that's the silver lining, is that it may now, in divided government at least, compel more advising and consenting as the Constitution requires. In a situation where one party dominates, you're right, the minority party will have virtually no say other than to slow down the inevitable, perhaps raise concerns and try to see if there are members of the majority party who disagree and can help block a nominee. in the increasingly partisan world that we live in, that is less likely. So the voice of the minority in this case is not necessarily going to be heard. It will put a premium on the partisan control of the Senate and make Supreme Court nominees or the prospect of them, I think, a much more central focus of any Senate campaign.
Well, we heard some of the Democrats criticizing Neil Gorsuch, and there also was a lot of criticism of the GOP, including Mitch McConnell, for not even allowing Merrick Garland to have a hearing, which makes you wonder whether the Garland situation was a 10-month-long or 10-9-month-long filibuster that was put in by the Republicans.
Yeah, it was unprecedented. We had never seen the Senate do what it did to Merrick Garland last year. Remember, within hours of Antonin Scalia's death in February of last year, Mitch McConnell made clear that, in his view, a president in the final year of his term, once a presidential campaign had begun, should not be the person to pick the next Supreme Court nominee. And depending on how you read history, there's some precedents for this in the past. And you can get tied up in the various partisan retellings of history when it comes to issues of the court. But yes, that the fact that Garland was rejected, in essence, or blocked, really stuck in the craw of Democrats and hung over this confirmation fight like nothing else, especially in the last few weeks. You couldn't go more than 15 minutes during Gorsuch's confirmation hearing without hearing Garland's name invoked by a Democrat angry at the fact that they weren't holding a hearing for Garland. And Gorsuch was forced a few times to at least confront questions about whether he thought that was fair. He dodged them, but it was brought up pretty frequently, and it was brought up just in the last few hours of the debate that led to invoking the nuclear option yesterday. What Mitch McConnell and Republicans did was unprecedented, and some would say unconstitutional or illegal. You can, insert your own adjectives in that case, but, it happened. And some hope, frankly, that now, after all these years of Democrats blocking Republican picks and Republicans blocking Democratic picks and Democrats having made some changes to the rules a few years ago and now Republicans having finished the changes to the rules, maybe now with a clean slate, the two parties can move ahead, try to focus again on rebuilding trust, work on some bipartisan legislation, and try to heal the wounds that really have inflicted this place for the last several years.
And how deep are those wounds? I mean, how much mistrust, anger at each other in the U.S. Senate, which is supposed to be a deliberative body, a place where cooler heads prevail?
I think the fact that yesterday happened, and happened so quickly and in such an organized fashion, I think I described it in the paper today as a carefully staged deconstruction. And no senator really stood in outrage or spoke out against it because they realized it was inevitable. And it was inevitable back in 2013 when the Democrats started the changes. Because at that point, and that change really infuriated Republicans. Democrats did it because Republicans have been blocking President Obama's picks. But at that point, everyone knew it's inevitable that at some point the change will be made for the Supreme Court picks. And that's essentially what McConnell started to threaten last year when Scalia died, that we will block Garland and we will get a Republican on here. Or if it was Hillary Clinton, they were going to have her nominee chosen. And we very well could have been sitting here in an alternative universe today,
exactly,
watching the confirmation of Clinton's pick. But, it's been done. And what I find interesting is that despite this change, I interviewed Minority Leader Chuck Schumer last week. He said, no, when it comes to legislation, I think we're okay. I don't see any support for getting rid of the legislation. And there is still a genuine desire among Democrats to work with Republicans and vice versa. We're going to see evidence of that most likely at the end of this month when they come back from a two-week recess and have essentially only 4 days to put together a spending agreement to keep the government open. Talks on that have been a while now, and there seems to be pretty good agreement between the two parties of what that spending agreement will look like, whether they can get it done right away on April 28th when the deadline happens, or maybe have to give themselves a week-long extension. We'll see. But all signs are that they're working very well together on that. Mm-hmm. Democrats want to work with Republicans on health care. It'll be up to the Republicans to come to Democrats to come up with some bipartisan solutions if they feel that that's needed. And on tax reform, there are talks underway already. We'll see whether or not later this year we witness any real bipartisan progress on that issue as well.
Interesting. They can work together on legislation, but when it comes to people or nominees, not so much. Is one of the arguments, though, especially for the U.S. Supreme Court, is that you need more than 51 votes because this is a person who could spend 20, 30, 40, maybe even more years on the court, and you don't want it to be a partisan pick. You want it to be a pick where you can get people from both sides.
Yeah, and that was the argument that Democrats were making this week, that if somebody's failing the 60-vote threshold, you don't change the rules, you change the nominee. That because this is a lifetime appointment. I mean, for example, Clarence Thomas right now, if he serves into his 80s, he's on course to be the longest-serving Supreme Court justice and may serve more than 40 years.
Wow.
The younger nominees are being put on the bench. You know, they very well could serve 30-plus years each, and that also makes vacancies, frankly, that much rarer. So it does put a premium on making sure that that the president and the senator are getting this right. That was the argument Democrats made, but of course Republicans turned around and said, well, you know, you guys are just blocking this guy because he's Donald Trump's pick. You know, he's got a unanimous well-qualified rating from the American Bar Association. Democratic legal minds like the guy, support his nomination. He's, you know, Ivy League educated. Has been a member of the appeals court out in Denver in good standing. You've got no reason to oppose him on the merits. You're just doing this for politics. And there's a ring of truth in that, frankly. They've been blocking all of Donald Trump's nominees so far this year and pretty much voting in block against them. And in this case, they're doing it as well. Justifiably, perhaps out of spite, because of what happened last year with Garland. But there's no doubt that Gorsuch, professionally at least, is qualified to serve on the court.
Ed, we have about 60 seconds before we have to say goodbye to you. Any Democrats going to vote for Neil Gorsuch today?
Yes, three. Joe Manchin of West Virginia, Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota, and Joe Donnelly of Indiana are expected to. The thing that ties them together is they are some of the most moderate Democrats in the Senate. They're up for re-election next year in states that Donald Trump won by double digits in November. 10 Democrats facing re-election next year are running in states that Trump won. 25 total Democrats are up for re-election next year, making it very difficult for Democrats to hold on to the seats they have. So those more moderate senators like Manchin, Heitkamp, and Donnelly, in these cases, have to demonstrate on key issues. This is one of them, and that's what we're at their votes today.
Ed, we're going to say goodbye to you. Thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Anytime. Take care.
You too. And he's a congressional reporter for The Washington Post, has been following the drama all this week and, frankly, before this week, the nomination of Neil Gorsuch going before the Senate today. And it looks like he will be the newest member of the court. Stay with us after this very short break. We'll be talking about the crisis of the middle class constitution. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Ganesh Sitaraman writes in the introduction to his new book that the gravest threat to our constitutional government is not gridlock in Washington, D.C. It's not the increased power of the presidency, the rise of the national security state, or the polarization of the parties. No, it's the collapse of the middle class. His book is The Crisis of the Middle Class Constitution. He says the founders envisioned a government based on a certain kind of economic and political equality that's been upended in recent years, exacerbated by the recent financial crisis and certain decisions made by the U.S. Supreme Court. He writes that economic and political inequality are linked, with wealthy elites now dominating the political system, and he has some ideas for closing that gap. He's associate professor of law at Vanderbilt Law School, also a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, and he was a longtime advisor to Senator Elizabeth Warren. And Ganesh, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. So what did the founders, how did they define what it was to be middle class?
Well, the most important thing about the founding period, and it's something that's surprising to all of us today, is that it was an era of relative economic equality. And I know that seems maybe even crazy to say, but when you think back to the late 18th century, what America was really a sparsely set of low population areas on the eastern seaboard of the Atlantic. There were some medium-sized towns, Philadelphia and New York. But when the founders looked across to what was, for them, the center of civilization, London, Paris, they saw how different they were. Unlike Europe, there was no feudalism in America. Unlike Europe, there was no hereditary aristocracy in America. The richest Americans, people like George Washington, who had these big homes like Mount Vernon and great lands, were just nothing compared to the dukes and duchesses of England in their giant marble palaces. And there was one other big difference, and that is that America had these vast lands available to the West, which meant that any white man, it was limited to white men at the time, could move west, get a parcel of land for themselves, and have a measure of economic opportunity, equality, and a chance to be in the big middle class that this country offered.
Of course, a lot of those lands were farmed by slaves. I mean, certainly slavery created a certain, it seems, a certain kind of aristocracy or certainly elite in this country living off the work of people who were enslaved.
So I think there's two traditions that we have to think about. The first one, which I describe in the book, I call the middle class constitutional tradition. What it says is that to have a republic, you have to have relative economic equality within the political community. And that's the kind of government we have. We have a constitutional system that assumes relative economic equality, and it's because the conditions at the time of the founding were as such. And that's what our Constitution was built upon. Now, the real question this leaves open is who's in the political community?
Exactly.
And throughout our history, that's a question that's been fiercely, including violently, contested. But there's another tradition, a tradition that over time has expanded the political community to include women, to include minorities. And we can think of this more inclusive tradition as an independent tradition. And what I think is really important is what happens when these two things overlap. When you expand the political community, you now have to ensure that all the new members of the political community can also join the middle class, or else the basic theory of how our Constitution was designed doesn't work anymore. And what's striking is that statesmen throughout our history actually understood that economic equality had to go hand in hand with political equality.
Well, I guess so when African Americans got the vote, when women got the vote, that created more, what, progressive laws, progressive policies that were more inclusive?
Well, so the case of post-Civil War Reconstruction is actually a great example. So after the Civil War, during Reconstruction, Reconstruction Republicans in the North, people like Thaddeus Stevens, a congressman from Pennsylvania, said that what we needed to do was confiscate the lands of the top 10% of Confederate rebel planters in the South and redistribute that land to the now freed slaves of the South. And the reason he said this is that because it was not possible to have a republic in the South, and that there had never really been a republic in the South until you had both political equality, which is what emancipation and political rights were going to give, and economic equality and economic justice, which his idea of confiscating lands and redistributing them were going to give. You know, this is the period where we come up with the idea 40 acres and a mule.
I was just thinking 40 acres and a mule.
And it's because Thad Stevens and others wanted to give parcels of 40 acres to the former freed slaves so that they would have and could be independent farmers themselves.
I do want to do a quick march through history because also you also write about the robber barons, and certainly there was a period in this country's history where people got extraordinarily wealthy, many of them doing quasi-criminal, or perhaps we look back now on their behavior and seeing it as, if not illegal, certainly criminal in some ways. So you've got this sort of interesting point-counterpoint, I guess, going on through history.
So what happens in the late 19th century, in what we now call the Gilded Age, is that everything changes economically. So the economic assumptions that undergirded our Constitution in the time of the founders are just uprooted. So we have industrialization. There's urbanization. There's the closing of the frontier. There's a shift from agriculture and artisanal work to wage labor in factories. And all of that puts real stress on our constitutional system. And populists in the late 19th century and progressives in the early 20th century recognize that this is a threat to our republic. And they see increasing economic inequality turning into increasing political inequality. Mm. And the robber barons, the plutocrats that you mentioned, are taking over government itself and rigging the system to serve themselves and their own preferences. And so the populists and progressives try to take action to address this kind of change. And it's one of the most creative and exciting reform periods in our history.
But are you also saying that an agriculturally based country is more democratic just because it's based on land and farming?
Well, not necessarily, but the founders, many of them thought that it would be. It doesn't have to be because, you know, in Europe, for example, you have feudalism, which is heavily agricultural, but feudalism is not democratic, quite the opposite. But in the founding era, the availability of lands meant that people could be independent farmers, have their own property, be self-sustaining, and have a measure of independence that would allow them to succeed in a democracy because they have that economic independence. So it's not always the case, but sometimes.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. When talking today on Radio Times with Ganesh Sitaraman, and his book is called The Crisis of the Middle Class Constitution, Why Economic Inequality Threatens Our Republic, a quick tour through American history. And you can join our conversation, any questions or comments for our guests. Our comment and text line is 267-405-2006. You can call, leave a message or leave a text, and we will play it or read it on the air. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY. Radio Times. You talk about the progressive movement, and you've got labor laws, you've got other different kinds of laws, I guess as a reaction to these robber barons, the plutocrats that were really driving the economy into the ground.
So the populists and the progressives really do two things that are extremely revolutionary and exciting in their own time. And in trying to translate the principles of the early republic and the founding to an era of industrialization, they first take aim at concentrated economic power. And so they come up with antitrust law, for example, as a way to break up consolidated economic power. But they also pass a constitutional amendment to create the income tax.
Yes.
So that people who have a greater ability to pay can pay more. On the political side, they pass the first campaign finance regulations because they want to prevent people who are economically powerful from having an undue influence over the political process. But they also pass a constitutional amendment to enable the direct election of U.S. senators rather than the selection of U.S. senators by state legislatures. And this is important because it takes power and gives it to the people. And there have been, in many states, bribery and other kinds of shenanigans going on in the state legislatures for picking U.S. senators. And so what they were trying to do is bring back a sense that America both needs an economic democracy and a political democracy, and that these two things go hand in hand.
They also pass prohibition. How does that figure in?
They pass a lot of things. So it's an exciting period where they pass prohibition. They also pass a constitutional amendment for women's suffrage. I think the unifying theme in the progressive era is in this time of extreme upheaval and change. In a lot of different ways. It's just modernization is happening around the globe. It's really our first era of globalization as well. What unites the progressives is a sense that people are losing control of their destiny, and they want to get that control back. And so they want to have mastery of these forces around them that just seem like they've gone unhinged and that we can't control them, and they think that every way we can do this. And so sometimes they are Democrats and they want to give more power to the people. Sometimes they support experts and bureaucracies because they think government is the way that they can control these forces. Sometimes they do things in social legislation like prohibition is an example of that. But the unifying theme is it's about the people trying to take control of the quick changes that are happening in society.
Talk a bit about President Roosevelt, FDR. Certainly we've got World War II, but also his progressive policies as well, how that figures in.
So the fights from the populist and progressive era really continue for decades and into the New Deal as well. And in the New Deal, we see a bunch of big changes that happen, the most important of which is actually one about the Supreme Court. And for a long time, the Supreme Court had really been a barrier to making progressive reforms with respect to the economy. The Supreme Court would strike down wages laws and hours laws and these kinds of legislation that were designed to help working class people. And in the Roosevelt administration, the court flips in 1937 and it starts upholding all of these laws. And that really changes things because now it becomes clear to everyone that it's constitutional for the federal government to address economic issues. And so really after that, debates over the economic policy leave the constitutional realm. And in large sense, you know, we forget that economic equality is essential to our republic, to our constitutional system, which is a common theme throughout our history before that.
It's interesting to think of the 1950s, and I don't think this is true for African Americans. In fact, I know it wasn't true for African Americans, but when you look at the 1950s for white people. It really was a time of a thriving middle class. People could buy homes. We saw the highway system being built. We saw housing being built again, largely keeping blacks out of that. But nonetheless, for middle class people, that was a unique, perhaps unprecedented decade.
So the period after World War II, really from the mid-1940s until the 1970s, is really a boom period for America. It's an exceptional period. Economists call it the Great Compression.
Yes.
GDP goes up, median wages go up, everybody's income is going up, even though there are big differences by race and other things, incomes are going up. And this is the era in which we build America's great middle class. And we do that in part by creating opportunity for people, like the GI Bill, sending a generation to college, FHA loans, letting people become homeowners. But we also lift up the poor in this period. Some of the policies started earlier, Social Security under Franklin Roosevelt, but then Medicare, Medicaid, Head Start, a lot of things that lift people up. And as a result, we end up with a very equal society toward the end of this time period. And inequality goes down. And this is part of the reason also why we sort of forget how important economic equality is to our republic. It's because we were succeeding. It was all working pretty well.
Well, so what broke it apart? I mean, I'm not sure how wide the gap is, I know, but it's shocking when you see the gap between the really rich, and they're really, really rich people now, and so many people that seem to be stuck in, if not poverty, certainly near poverty.
Well, so I'll give you one statistic between the wealthiest people and everybody else. You know, the top 1% of people in America took home about 8.5% of the nation's income in 1976. So top 1% took 8.5% of the income.
In 76.
In 1976. These days, it's more than 20%. Top 1% takes home a fifth of America's income. So there's been a huge amount of concentration at the very top. And as a result, as we all know, everyone else feels increasingly squeezed and insecure economically. People are worried about retirement, worried about paying for their kids to get to college, worried about debt. And this is a real problem. There's less security economically in our society now.
And was it because we changed our tax system that we looked at wages and perhaps dividends differently?
So I think there are a lot of things that happened that were changes. Taxes are certainly a part of it. You know, we often forget the top marginal tax rates were extremely high in the post-World War II era.
Like 90%.
90%.
Did anyone ever pay
that? And
then
they went down to 70%.
But
these were high rates. And the estate tax is another one, which was high, and people did pay. And that has dropped off considerably over the years. So tax policy is one part. Labor policy is another. You know, we used to have a huge part of our population that were part of unions, and unions were and are really still the only people in Washington that advocate consistently on behalf of working people, whether unionized or not. Most of the interest groups in Washington don't do that. And what we've seen is a deliberate attack on unions over the course of the last generation and the dismantling of unions, both by the Supreme Court and by efforts in states throughout the country. And that's really hurt working people a lot as well. We also shifted in a broad sense on where our policies were, not just in taxes and unions, but also in how we invest. So, you know, it used to be the case that you could go to a public college and not spend too much money for that. Now prices are through the roof. That's a function of choices that we make as a society. Do we want all of our kids to be able to get an affordable higher education, or do we not? And that's a choice. It's not given by fate or by God or by nature. It's something that we decide, whether we really value that opportunity for all of our kids or whether we don't. And I think over the last 30 years, we've made choices that have really undermined the creation of a big middle class.
Is it any accident that we have so many millionaires serving in the U.S. Congress?
You know, I think it's troubling that we see so many millionaires in the Congress, billionaires in the cabinet. And the reason why is it's not anything about people who've been successful. It's that it turns out the political scientists show that systematically wealthier people have different preferences about policy than everybody else. And they tend, and it's not everybody, you know, you can always find some exceptions, but they tend to support tax cuts for themselves. They tend to be against regulation. They tend to be not as interested in public education because they send their kids to private schools. And so by and large, what that means is that you get a skewed sense of what the policies are that you're going to get out of the government, and they're not going to represent what's in the public good. They're going to represent what's in the private interests of a very small number of people. And this is a real problem because it creates a vicious cycle that as we have policies that support the wealthy get wealthier, then they use their wealth to influence policy. And that just creates this the same thing. One commentator calls this the doom loop of oligarchy.
The doom loop of oligarchy.
And it's very, very hard to get out of that once you get into it.
And I guess you can throw in then lobbyists. I'm thinking about our tax system. I'm not sure how many pages it is now, but I know it's just thousands and thousands of pages. And looking at our tax system, how much that benefits people that have money. And I know there's a large segment of the population that doesn't even make enough money to pay federal income tax.
So the tax system is sort of a problem, partly because of the fact that it is less progressive probably than it needs to be in the sense that wealthier people could pay more, have a greater ability to pay. And many of them do want to pay more. You know, you talk to there's lots of reports about Warren Buffett, for example,
yes,
being happy to pay more in taxes and thinks that people like him should pay more. So I think that is a serious problem. At the lobbying level, you know, what's really extraordinary is how many lobbyists there are in Washington and how effective they are at influencing both the legislative process and the regulatory process. And I think this is a real problem. And if we want to be serious, we have to elect people and create change that pushes out the influence from lobbyists and other special interests.
I want to pick up on that after this very short break. We're going to get back to our conversation with Ganesh Sitaraman, and he is the author of a new book called The Crisis of the Middle Class Constitution, subtitled Why Economic Inequality Threatens Our Republic. He was a longtime advisor to Senator Elizabeth Warren. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, and he's an associate professor of law at Vanderbilt Law School. A lot of people want to join the conversation. Our email address, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, text or call our comment line 267-405-2006. We'll pick up on where we left off and I'll read a bunch of comments as well. Stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoing talking with Ganesh Sitaraman.
Sitaraman.
I was so good until this very, very moment here. And again, his new book is called The Crisis of the Middle Class Constitution. Let me read a couple of comments here. One from Bob. He says, James Madison said, quote, protect the minority of the opulent against the majority. How do you reconcile this quote with the idea that the United States was founded with the idea of economic equality?
It's a great question. So, you know, one of the things about the founding period is that there's a lot of different themes that are going on in this period. And in every one of the thinkers of this period and actors of this period, Jefferson, Madison, Hamilton, you can find different kinds of traditions intellectually and arguments that they're making in different contexts and different arguments throughout their lives, in fact. What I think is so striking about our Constitution and why it's based on this economic equality idea is how different it is and how radical it is from previous constitutions. And that's the right baseline that we need to think about as opposed to kind of one quote here or there. And what's different is that for most of history prior to the 18th century and to the Americans, people were very worried about the problem of economic inequality. They were worried that the rich would oppress the poor would confiscate the wealth of the rich, and the result would be strife, violence, and revolution. And the answer to this problem, the way to solve this, was to build economic class right into the structure of government. So in England, you have the House of Lords for the wealthy, House of Commons for everybody else. In ancient Rome, you have the Patrician Senate for the wealthy. You've got the Tribune of the Plebs for the plebeians for everybody else. And the idea is that both classes have a check on each other and also a share in government. And that's what creates stability. Now, what's striking about our Constitution is we don't have that. We don't have a Tribune of the Plebs. We don't have property requirements for becoming a United States senator. And the founders knew about these things. They debated things like property requirements for office holders in their state constitutions. They even adopted them in the state constitutions of the Revolutionary period, but not in our federal Constitution. I think that's a radical change. And the reason why we don't have those kinds of checks, and they say this, and I'll encourage the commenter to take a look at the book. The reason why is because they believe that we don't have the deep problems of economic inequality, so we don't need those kind of checks.
But have we not then, even based on your argument, ended up with the kind of constitution that the founders were trying to right against, in that we have so many powerful people in government, so many people. It wasn't a requirement to have a lot of money or to have a lot of land, but that's what we've ended up with.
So this is one of the real concerns, is that you have a mismatch between the economic conditions that were essential to having our republic and the structure of our government. And what's happened is the economics have changed. We now have a very unequal society, but we still have a constitution designed for a very equal society. And so the question is, how do we deal with that? And I think there's really two options. We can try to realign this mismatch by reducing inequality and putting our constitution in line with having a greater middle class, or we would have to abandon the constitutional system that the founders wanted and go back to the tribune of the plebs kind of a structure, which I call class warfare constitutions in the book. And that would be the other option. And I think, you know, for a lot of people, that would be an undesirable, including for me, and sort of outlandish option.
So what do we do? I mean, I'm thinking of Citizens United, McCutcheon, some of these laws passed by the Supreme Court that seems to exacerbate what it is you're describing.
So I think there's two sets of things that we can do. And the real inspiration for these things is the actions of the populists and the progressives who confronted a very similar situation about 100 years ago. And that is, first, we have to think about what we can do to take action on the economic side to restructure our economy so that it works for people. Now, you know, the economy is not something that emerges magically out of thin air. It's actually constructed by laws. We have contract laws and property laws and antitrust laws and all of these laws, and we get to choose the kind of economy we want to live in, and we can have labor protections. We can have minimum wages. We can do all of those things, and I think that's one really important part of the actions we need to take. The second part is that we really have to do things to prevent wealth from having an undue influence in our political system. And you know, you mentioned Citizens United and McCutcheon, but I think that's a critical part of it, is the campaign finance system, which is a real problem, not just because of the possible influence it has over elected officials, but because it requires elected officials to spend all this time raising money, especially from wealthy people. And if you do that, that's time that you're not spending actually considering issues. It's time that you're not spending with your constituents. It's time that you're not spending really doing the work of the American people. It's time you're spending hanging out with a bunch of very wealthy people who, as I mentioned before, systematically tend to have different preferences than the general population.
But the Supreme Court ruled that speech is money. Money is speech. How do we get beyond that?
Well,
and then I'll read some more comments here.
Well, there's two ways that Supreme Court decisions can be changed. One is the Supreme Court can change its own decisions. That requires a majority on the court to overturn an existing precedent. That happens sometimes, but very rarely. So that would be one approach. The second approach is to have a constitutional amendment that overturns the Supreme Court's decision and the Supreme Court's interpretation of the Constitution. And in fact, this is something that we've done in our history. A great example of this is the Supreme Court in 1895 strikes down the income tax. And this creates a lot of popular pressure to have a constitutional amendment to instate the income tax. And we pass one. We pass a constitutional amendment to do that in direct response to the Supreme Court decision. It takes a long time to get there. It's not easy. Passing a constitutional amendment never is.
No.
But this is the kind of thing that we really need to take seriously, because if we don't address these problems, we will lose our republic. And that's a real concern, I think, to everybody, regardless of your political views.
And by losing the republic, meaning sort of losing the popular control of our government?
Yeah, a republic is just a representative democracy. And what the problem that happens, though, is that over time, if you have more and more influence from the wealthiest people, you don't have a representative democracy. You have a government that represents the wealthiest people. In history, we call that either an aristocracy or an oligarchy or a plutocracy, but none of those are a republic. And I'll just say one thing about this. You know, all of these terms, oligarchy and aristocracy, sort of seem crazy now, like something out of ancient history. But for most of American history, they weren't. And the reason why is because throughout our history, people left aristocracies in Europe and monarchies in Europe to come to a republic, America. They knew that there was a difference between aristocracies and republics. They knew that there were societies that had lords and ladies and that had wealthy classes that had power and that everyone else didn't. And that was a normal thing in the kind of governments that existed in the world in the 19th century, in the 18th century, even in the early 20th century, you know, we've forgotten in a way that that kind of government exists. And the danger is that if we're not attuned to that, we might end up with one.
Let me read some more comments. A tweet from Garabi saying, how does your guest understand this is Neil Gorsuch? Neil Gorsuch's originalist interpretation of the Constitution in light of your thesis. I mean, the idea of going back to the Constitution, what were the founders thinking? What do you think? How do you see Gorsuch's interpretation?
So, you know, I unfortunately haven't had a chance myself to talk to Judge Gorsuch about the book, but we'll look forward to sending him a copy of it and hopefully engaging him at some point on it. You know, I think for anyone who is an originalist, one of the questions that you have to think about is, you know, when we talk about the original public meaning of the Constitution and the original structural understanding of the Constitution, what was the world the founders were inhabiting? How did they think about it? And how did they think about the structure of the Constitution in that context? And I think what I argue in the book is that this tradition of economic equality is something that law professors, judges, and others have severely, if not completely, ignored, even though it's a major theme at this time period. And, you know, we tend to have a tendency to think that the founding generation was just like us in every possible way. But actually, it was a couple hundred years ago.
It was
a very, very different time period. And we have to do careful and thorough historical work to pull out the different strands. And there are lots of different ones. I'm not saying this is the only strand, but we have to pull out lots of different strands and try to understand this period. And I think this set of themes is one that has been neglected by originalists, by law professors generally.
A text from a listener, is it not time to eliminate the Electoral College? Wouldn't that be a step towards more economic empowerment?
So I think the Electoral College is another one of these cases where we have a structure in our government that is undemocratic in the sense that it is not directly democratic, elected by the people. It has this kind of pass-through component to it. And it does that in two ways. One is it has an electoral college. The set of people who are the actual ones who get to vote for president are these electors, not all of us. We technically vote for the electors who vote for the president.
Exactly, which is always – every 3 or 4 years is always a surprise.
Sort of an interesting thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
But the other part of the Electoral College is what the Electoral College does is it sets up voting through the states. So states are allocated votes, and that reshapes how people have influence over politics. And so there's two ways in which we might think of this as undemocratic and where we could address trying to make our system more democratic. But, you know, to the commenter's point on that, you know, one thing I would add is there are other areas where we don't talk as much about, but that are very important for making our system more democratic. Voting is one of them. We make it very hard for a lot of people to vote, not just through things like ID laws, but we vote on Tuesdays instead of on weekends.
I know.
So in some states, you can only vote on Tuesday rather than having an early voting period. You know, people have jobs. They've got kids. This is not an easy thing to carve out time to stand in line and vote. If we really believe in our democracy, as I do, I think what we should do is make it easy for people to vote and make it something you should be proud of to be part of the, you know, electoral process and the political process. And that means everybody should be able to vote, and we should make it easy for them to vote instead of throwing up these roadblocks for what is fundamentally a core part of what it means to be a citizen.
Would that require a constitutional amendment, or is that just something that states by
voting doesn't changing the day of what? Voting doesn't require a constitutional amendment. We can do this. States have lots of different rules about voting. Some do early voting. Mm-hmm. Some do voting by mail. There's lots of different opportunities to make progress there.
There's something you say at the very end of your book here about this populist fervor. Some on the right, some on the left. Do you think we're on the cusp of some kind of progressive age or era the way we were, let's say, 100 years ago?
So I hope we are, but I don't think I'm, you know, naive enough to say that we definitely are. You know, when you study history even a little bit, one of the things that's striking is how contingent everything is and how things can change. Lots of unexpected events, whether in world affairs or economic mm-hmm. affairs or natural disasters or any number of things can change the trajectory of history. But what I think, you know, for all the division in our society, for how deeply divided we seem to be, one thing that I think we have in common is that whether, you know, people supported Trump or Bernie Sanders, there's a real sense that the economy is not working for a lot of American people. And that the government is not working for a lot of the American people. And I think that actually, that commonality should give us some hope that we can mobilize and try to change the system.
Let me play a couple of comments, people that called our comment line. The first one from Frank, and Frank is calling us from Philadelphia. Let's give it a listen.
My name is Frank, Philadelphia. I'm calling about the emollients, which is the provision in the law and the government about ethic violations. And the Trump administration is in serious violation of that, including having a son-in-law who does his bidding in the political process and even in foreign policy. That is an egregious miscarriage of democracy.
We're all learning about the emoluments clause. I think something that people hadn't thought about a year ago. How do you see that?
So I think, you know, the emoluments clause, and there are other clauses in the Constitution. Another one that we have, a ban on titles of nobility is another clause, are designed because the founders were very concerned about corruption. They were concerned about corruption from foreign governments. They were concerned about corruption within the government. And I think one of the striking things for people who go back and read about the history of the founding era is how skeptical so many of the founders were about commerce and business. And I know it sounds crazy because we're a very entrepreneurial and economically advanced country, but the founders were skeptical because they worried that people who cared a lot about their own pecuniary interests would be likely to support those interests and not the public good. And they were concerned that this would be a corruption of the common good, a corruption of the kind of virtue that was needed to be a true statesman in office. And that's why provisions like that existed. It's to try to separate out the idea that you can aggrandize yourself, whether it's financially or through a title or something like that, instead of just serving the people. And I think that's a real a concern that we have today, and it's something that we don't think and talk enough about.
I'm thinking about the fact that you worked for Senator Elizabeth Warren for so many years. She was the person behind the Consumer Protection Bureau. It looks like it's now on the chopping block. If that's sort of an example of an agency that was there to help consumers who were hurt by the financial crisis, and now it looks like its days could be numbered, or it could be, in a sense, sort of lose its ability to try to control some of this stuff, where does that leave us?
Well, I think in a lot of areas right now, whether it's the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the Environmental Protection Agency, the Department of Education, the Federal Communications Commission, or you know, across a lot of these agencies, what you're seeing is an administration that wants to roll back a lot of the protections that are out there for workers, for the environment, for ordinary people. You know, just the other day we saw in Congress a repeal of the regulation that allows internet service providers to collect all your data when you're searching the internet on what websites you're visiting and so on, and sell that information. I still haven't met anybody who supports that. I assume the people at the internet companies
don't hang out with the right people.
I'm guessing the people at the internet companies do, but ordinary people don't support that kind of thing. And part of the reason why we see these attacks on things that a lot of people really agree with and that are really helping a lot of people in the country is that we have a lot of lobbying.
Yeah.
And that's something that we really need to take aim at if we want to make progress.
Well, I appreciate the fact that you joined us on Radio Times, giving us a lot to think about and talk about.
Thanks so much. It's been really great to be here.
Great to have you with us as well. Ganesh Sitaraman's book is called The Crisis of the Middle Class Constitution, Why Economic Inequality Threatens Our Republic. And he is an assistant or associate professor of law at Vanderbilt Law School, associate professor, and senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.